biochars on greenhouse gas production potentials.
Thank you, David. And like you said, I also have to thank Don Rakowski or Mr. Carbon for getting me involved in the biochar, as well as David Laird. So today, I want to talk a little bit about the effects of biochar on greenhouse gas production. As you've been hearing through the session today, there's been a lot of benefits attributed to biochar addition to soils. However, a majority of these results have come from the oxisols, with the Terra Parata soils down in South America. So what we're really focusing on is what happens to the greenhouse gas production and consumption with the addition of biochars to other soil types. So the biochar research that I'm involved with is all part of a ARS multi-location initiative called the Biochar and Pyrolysis Initiative, which has been spearheaded in Ames, Iowa by David Laird. There are five other locations in addition to Ames, with Kimberly, Idaho, St. Paul, Big Spring, Texas, Florence, South Carolina, and Prosser, Washington, and you've heard some of their results prior to mine today. We're all using a fast pyrolysis char that is being applied in replicated field plots. We all are using continuous corn, using the same crop for comparison between locations. In addition to following the crop yield and soil carbon in St. Paul, we're also doing the soil gas concentration and trace gas fluxes, as well as tracking seedling emergence and growth rates. So in St. Paul or Rosemont, Minnesota, we've established some biochar field trials. I currently have three different biochars in the field plots. The first one is a fast pyrolysis, the sawdust from Sequest from Dynamotive, and then that is with and without a manure addition. And then I've also added a slow pyrolysis biochar, which was made from wood chips from Best Energies, as well as another slow pyrolysis biochar of a macadamia nut from Biochar Brokers. And we'll be adding this year a slow pyrolysis updraft gasifier char made from wood pellets from Chip Energy. And I'll get to why we're adding that one in a little bit here. We also have some larger strip plots because the majority of these chars, as you've heard, are in very short supply. So to even get enough char for a 16 by 16 plot is a difficult task. We were able to get some other chars in higher quantities, the macadamia nut and the ground lump charcoal char from Kingsford. This isn't the straight Kingsford charcoal, it's actually a lump charcoal that they produce and not the charcoal briquettes. So with those larger strip plots, we're actually looking at three different rates of 5, 10, and 20,000 pounds per acre. But today I primarily wanted to focus on some of the laboratory studies that I've been doing. So today I'm going to present the results on 24 different chars that we've evaluated the impact on greenhouse gas production and consumption. As was mentioned, there was a prior conference in Boulder, and at that point I had 16 different chars, so you get to see eight other chars that weren't presented there. So it was kind of mentioned that we have some messy slides. To get all this data from all the chars was very difficult on one slide, so I actually broken up into two parts. The first is chars number 1 through 16. And you can see here that there is a variety of parent materials ranging from corn stovers, pine chips, peanut hulls, some turkey manure and wood chip mixtures. And I also have a coconut shell activated charcoal as the BC13. Maybe keep track of that number in the back of your head, as well as a macadamia shells down at number 16. Just keep that number in the back of your mind as well. You can see that the percent carbons range anywhere from 1 all the way up to about 83% on this slide. And you see our range in nitrogen and oxygen and ash contents. The other thing I'd like to point out is there's been a lot of corollary drawn between biochars and activated charcoals. And you can see here in our BC13 for the activated charcoal surface area, we're about 960 meters squared per gram. You look at all of our other biochars, and there's only one that even comes close at number 10 in the 300 meters squared per gram range. The rest of them are extraordinarily small. We're down, some of them are even less than a meter squared per gram. And so one has to ask, well, why is that? So if we look at our remaining other eight chars here, 17 through 22 was provided to me from the Illinois Sustainable Technology Center, and they used a dry distiller's grain from an ethanol plant in the pyrolysis, and I had two different temperatures of that. They also had two corn cob chars that were at two different temperatures, as well as a mixed wood waste composed of both hard and soft wood. Char number 23 is a little unique because it's derived from an algae through a hydrothermal carbonization. So this char is not a pyrolysis char, but it's actually created through a hydrothermal carbonization process. And the last one is the sawdust, the Dynamotive Sequest Char that results from the hardwood sawdust. So in overview, we have 11 different biomass parent materials in the study. This offers a fairly good cross-sectional sampling of the available biochars currently. I put biochars in quotes because you can see the next line below it. Our carbon content ranges from 1 to 84% carbon. Officially, the biochar definition is being tossed about in the standardization committee, but they're generally saying that you have to be above 50% carbon to be considered a biochar. But anyhow, these are all currently the biomass residual products that are available then. So the nitrogen contents range from 0.1 to 2.7%. We have a range in our production temperatures from 350 to 850 degrees C. And as I was mentioning, our surface areas range from that tenth of a meter per gram all the way up to 980 meters squared per gram. So in our two of the chars, number 3 and 10, it is a peanut hull, and the only difference between them was where they were stored for a year. Number 3 was actually just stored in the lab, and number 10 was stored outside on a pile. What you see is the change in the one-year storage in our compositional data. Our carbon has remained about the same. However, we have almost a loss of about 1.8% of our nitrogen, as well as a dramatic increase in our surface area, going from 10 to 286 meters squared per gram. This I attribute to the volatiles that are attached to the char. If you immediately analyze the char after production, because it is an absorptive media, it has absorbed some of the bio-oils, the biogas that are in these reactors. And so the first thing you have to remember when you're utilizing these chars is you do have these absorbed materials on the char itself. And we really have to decide whether we want to account for that in our mineralization rates or if we want to subtract that. So the next thing we did was look at these in a laboratory incubations. The one difference here, since I did have 24 different chars, I also looked at soils from three different ecosystems. The first was the Minnesota agricultural soil, Waukegan silt loam, as well as a Wisconsin forest nursery soil and a villus loamy sand. And then I also utilized a California landfill cover soil, a Marina loamy sand. And the reasons for this I'll get to in a little bit. But between these three soils, I feel I have a fairly good representation of some diverse ecosystem effects. So I want to go over a little bit on the methodologies. You've been seeing a lot of data on carbon mineralization throughout these initial talks. What we did is we took 5 grams of soil, mixed it with a half a gram of biochar, or we have a 10% weight-weight comparison. All of our incubations we conducted at field capacity. And then we also have soil alone plus biochar alone incubations, and I'll show you the importance of that in just a little bit. The one other thing that we do is a 10-day pre-incubation. So after we mix these materials and get them up to the correct moisture, we leave them sit for 10 days and we don't actually analyze that period. This is in agreement with all of the work that's being done on soil microbial respiration studies, where they all have a 10-day to 2-week pre-incubation period before they actually do their analysis. So we've been instituting that, and by using, we have a headspace that's monitored periodically then with the GCMS, and the production rates are estimated from the change in the headspace concentrations with time. And as you can see over on the right, with the combination of that 10-day pre-incubation period, as well as our restriction on keeping the oxygen concentrations greater than 15%, we get a very linear CO2 production rate over time. When there's a poster down in the session today that actually shows some of the other impacts of low oxygen content on CO2 respiration. So this is a thing that has to be kept in mind when we're doing the respiration studies on biochar. So when I said that we actually had the biochar controls, what we actually did is just looked at the biochar alone sealed in the serum bottle with and without water additions. And what you see here is the actual production rates of CO2 resulting from the char material itself with and without moisture. And what I've had to plot these on a log scale because there is such a wide variety in the rates. The red line on this graph represents the average basal soil rate. And so what you see is we actually have some chars that produce more CO2 than a soil analog. So if you don't actually account for the CO2 production that's created from the biochar alone, you get a false information on the impact of the biochar plus soil combination. And so what you see overall is that there's 9 of the biochars that are above our average soil respiration and 15 that are below. Then there's been a lot of debate about whether this biochar can absorb methane and nitrous oxide. And so what we actually looked at was if there is the potential of this biochar to absorb methane. And what you see is that overall there's a one char, that BC16, which was the macadamia nut biochar. That one actually has an extraordinarily high production rate of methane, as well as the BC23, which was the algae, the hydrothermal carbonization char. So both of those chars, it was either due to their production time or due to the fact that they still were microbially active, we actually got a high production of methane from those. There were 2 chars, the BC3 and 4, that actually absorbed some trace amounts of methane, as well as the BC6, which was a compost plus biochar mix that we received from the supplier. And so that one you actually see does have a methane oxidation potential because it is microbial active as well. So then we actually look at the nitrous oxide absorption or production from the char alone. And here you see for our 24 chars, that BC23, which was the algae hydrothermal carbonization char, has an enormous capacity to eliminate or absorb or denitrify nitrous oxide in its native state. The remainder of the biochars don't show any evidence of any strong nitrous oxide absorption at ambient concentrations. A lot of the absorption studies in the literature on charcoals are all done at 10% or 100% nitrous oxide. When you translate those down to ambient levels, we really don't see a drastic impact in the absorption. So what does this all mean? Basically, we have to apply a correction in order to look at what the true impact of a biochar plus soil combination is. So you can see here that the CO2 production rate for the correction would be simply the CO2 of the soil plus biochar system minus the CO2 from the biochar alone, divided by our 5 grams of soil, divided by the time that we're interested in. The major assumption in this, and I have no data to prove that this is occurring, is if the biochar is actually producing the CO2 or absorbing the methane at the same rates as it does in the controls once it's intermixed with the soil. But for right now, the best assumption that I can make, the best guess, is to account for that activity in the combined system by using the biochar control. So when we look at our 3 soils, these are all the corrected CO2 production rates. You can see that overall for the agricultural soil, we have 8 of the biochars that stimulated CO2 production over the control rate, with a couple of them being extraordinarily high in that BC6, which was the compost biochar, the BC14, which was that updraft gasifier char, the BC16, which was that macadamia nut, as well as BC23, which was a hydrothermal carbonization algae. Then we look at the forest nursery soil, and we see slightly different trends. We see that we still have the stimulation in the BC14, which is that updraft gasifier char, but then we also have the BC23 having a high production, but the thing we're missing in this one is for BC6, which actually showed a suppression of the CO2 respiration rate. So for the forest nursery soil, 11 of the 24 chars stimulated the production, and 9 reduced, with the remainder being a non-significant change. Then on the bottom is the landfill cover soil. Here we see a very drastic difference in the behavior. We only have 3 of the chars that stimulated CO2 production, and we had 18 that reduced CO2 production, and we only had 2 that resulted in no change. So what you see just for the CO2 is that there is a drastic difference in the behavior of these chars depending on what soil they're mixed with. So the next is looking at methane. There's been a lot of reference to the biochars improving methane oxidation. So the sole purpose of this was to look at what happens for the chars for on methane oxidation. You can see in the agricultural soil, we started with about a 6 nanogram per gram per day oxidation rate. 23 of the 24 chars reduced that methane oxidation rate. We only had one char, the BC16, that resulted in a non-significant reduction or no change. The forest nursery soil was a reverse of this. We actually had methane production in the native soil. And what we see here is that unilaterally, all of the biochars reduced methane production in the forest nursery soil. Now, the reason I added the landfill cover soil is they are the soils with the highest naturally occurring methane oxidation capacities that you can find in an ecosystem. This particular landfill cover soil that I used from California had about minus 17 nanograms per gram per day oxidation potential. And what you see there is all 24 biochars reduced that methane oxidation potential, with a couple of them even creating a methane production side to a landfill cover soil. So then we come to the nitrous oxide. In the top picture, we show the agricultural soil again. We had two biochars that stimulated nitrous oxide production. The BC6, which was the compost amended biochar, as well as a BC16, which was a fresh macadamia nut biochar. I don't have a good explanation for why BC16 stimulated in the ag soil, but as far as the BC6, we're adding nitrogen to the agricultural soil with the biochar, so it's just a natural product that we end up with a higher nitrous oxide production. But you see, for 22 of the 24 chars, we did result in reduced nitrous oxide production. In the forest nursery soil, we had three of the chars that stimulated nitrous oxide. 16 chars reduced, with five resulting in no significant change. And in the landfill cover soil, we had two that stimulated nitrous oxide production, and overall 21 of the 24 chars reduced it. And for the nitrous oxide picture, the only universal response we had was from BC6, and you can see that with the red arrow in the bottom. That was the biochar plus compost mixture, and that one stimulated nitrous oxide almost unilaterally across all the soil types. And so what do we actually come to here? We had 24 different chars, and what I'm looking at here is all of their impact on the agricultural soils. Over on the left side, you see the soil control in black. The next char, there's what I'm calling the campfire char. That basically is a char that I grabbed out of a campfire or a fire pit before it was fully burned and scraped the black char material off to get an aerobic char, as well as BC23, which is the hydrothermal carbonization char, BC14, which is the updraft gasifier char that used air for the updraft. So what you see on the left in the blue is what I'm classifying as aerobically produced chars, chars that mimic the natural wildfire and prairie fire chars. And what you see for the agricultural soils, their aerobic chars stimulate production. On the right-hand side, we have all our pyrolytic chars. All of those chars decrease production, with the exception of BC16, which was that freshly produced biochar, BC3, which was the char that we stored inside the lab after production, and then BC10, you see it just slightly increased, but really results in no increase. So what I'm attributing this to is that on BC16 and 3, the CO2 that we're seeing there is from the volatile material, but overall the char of a pyrolysis char is, at least in the 100-day incubation, we do not see any CO2 that could be attributed to that char, so resulting in extraordinarily recalcitrant nature. But the aerobic chars, we do see the degradation, we do see the increased mineralization. This could lead to solve a lot of the debates right now between the Wardle study in Nature that looked at the naturally produced forest char that is an aerobic char that could increase the soil organic carbon turnover from our results here, compared to the pyrolytic chars, which there is no evidence right now of increasing soil organic turnover. So overall, in conclusions, not all biochars are the same. as you've heard from other speakers. The greenhouse gas production, the one take-home message that I hope that you take out of this, is it's complicated by the biochar production, release, or sorption, and it requires the correction to be applied to the soil incubations to determine the true impact or mineralization of that char. Overall, the greenhouse gas impact is a function of both the char and the soil. As far as the gas results, all of the chars appear to reduce nitrous oxide production potential. The only exception we had in that was the BC6, which is a compost plus char. And it is a different story at other water contents besides field capacity, but the universality is it does suppress nitrous oxide production. And then besides the BC14 char, which is an updraft gasifier char, there is no consistent trends in the CO2 across soil types. A majority reduced basal CO2 respiration in high activity soils. In lower activity soils, there in the forest nursery, there was a general trend that they had a majority of them increasing production. And there's some indication of the aerobic or the natural versus pyrolysis production differences. And biochars reduced soil methane oxidation activity as well as soil methane production activity. So you kind of look at the three major points, and overall biochars are reducing soil microbial activity rates after they're mixed. And with that, I'd like to thank all the cooperation I have on getting these chars from Dynamotive, Best Energies, the Illinois Sustainable Technology Center, biochar brokers and Chip Energy, as well as my technical support back at St. Paul. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Kurt?
So what's the mechanism of CO2 release from dry chars?
That's the million-dollar question. It's not photo oxidation because these incubations are done in the lab in dark. So we initially thought that it was just CO2 that was absorbed inside the porous structure of the chars. It was a degassing. We tried doing pretreatments with vacuum, doing a hexane rinse, and we really didn't impact the CO2 production significantly. So there's been a lot of research done on charcoals, and there's a lot of abiotic mechanisms that is basically the chemisorption of oxygen in the aromatic ring structure that leads to degradation and breakdown of the ring structure releasing CO2. And so right now, that's what I'd have to attribute as a major mechanism.
And what's the percentage of that compared to the percentage of CO2 that would be coming out of the soil?
For some of the chars, it is two orders of magnitude higher than soil respiration. That BC16 had a rate that was 1.8 milligrams per gram of char per day. Our soil was only respiring about 22 micrograms. So, I mean, it really depends on the soil type. If this, the impact of the char release is going to be a function of how well and what the respiration rate is of the soil that you're testing it on. But the important take-home message is you need to account for that biochar production.
Any thoughts on how long that process will persist as a significant source of CO2?
Yeah, I mean, so far we've only carried these out for 100 days or until the oxygen drops below the 15%. So I really don't have a long-term study yet. The one thing that you can kind of see is looking at that weathered char comparison. Once it's outside for a year, the CO2 production was halved. So there is an indication that this does decrease, but we don't have the data yet to show that either.
Just one point on this. Do you take into account the pH of the char? Because if it's, as a couple of speakers before, if it's too high, you'll have internal trapping of the carbon dioxide by the alkaline.
Yeah, and I mean, that could be another mechanism that's contributing to this. What I was looking at is just the major effects on the soil system. So I wasn't looking specifically at a pH-only effect. I was saying, well, if we mix this biochar with these soil types, what is the overall impact on the greenhouse gas production consumption?
Open in the air and let it
My personal preference would be that all charge should be steam activated at minimum, because that will clean off the bio oils, it'll clean off a lot of the trapped volatiles, and all of a sudden we'll be seeing a more uniform chemistries. Right now we have a hodgepodge. Each batch that comes out of these pyrolysis units are unique in themselves. Even though we have the same feedstock, the same set temperatures, if you actually get down to the nuts and bolts, each of those batches are a little unique. And I don't mean to fault to the production side of them, but it's a very difficult thing, pyrolyzing biomass, because you actually have a lot of oxygen within the biomass structure that doesn't lend itself to create the aromatic, tightly dense aromatic structures. Once you have oxygen in these reactions, you don't know where that oxygen is going to end up. The steam activation of, oh, that's already done routinely on all activated charcoals. There's basically two major processes, the KOH or the steam activation for charcoals. But these are all on extraordinarily large industrial scales right now. There's
tremendous costs associated with that, and this stuff is already too expensive to be used in, on any kind of widespread basis.
Correct. I mean, there's...
And if we're going to be looking at biochars, even though we do have tremendous variability out there, if we think we're going to put it out in agricultural use, we have to look at what the farmer's going to see.
Correct. Well, there's two, I have two kind of comments to that. One is if we find a very unique niche for this biochar, it could either be in nursery production, it could be in the high-value crop production. From the field studies so far in the Midwest, we have not seen the tremendous yield bumps that have occurred in the oxazoles. Correct. So, I mean, all of a sudden, what is the value for the farmer to apply biochar if he's not going to get the yield bumps? It all boils down to the carbon sequestration crediting. That's what everyone is waiting on, and we're seeing what's coming out of Copenhagen, if soils are even going to be included this go around. So there's a lot of what ifs and a lot of uncertainty about this whole thing. The one aspect of this is if the nitrous oxide reductions are tremendously important. Because all of a sudden, if we can mix biochar with urea applications to reduce the nitrous oxide impact of agriculture, we have a tremendous impact to make. The reductions that we're seeing in the lab are almost unbelievable in terms of a chemical reduction. And you just can't get inhibitors to work this well to change from nitrous oxide producing to non or even actual absorption of nitrous oxide.
Nitrous oxide is 300 times the radiative forcing of CO2, and estimated from emissions from agricultural land actually exceed the CO2 impact. So this is a very important side of this equation.
So what's the mechanism then of reducing the nitrous oxide? Is it inhibiting organism substrate? What? And given that, what about the fact that these are have high torch velocity, and are you really seeing a reduction because it's limiting the production of N2O, or is it just trapped within the matrix of that biochar?
I guess from my standpoint, these are very small lab incubations. I have 5 grams of soil with the biochar. I don't foresee a mechanism that would be able to trap enough in that matrix that I have in these incubations. This nitrous oxide reduction has been seen in some preliminary field plot work, and they saw about 60% reduction, where in the lab incubations we're seeing higher. The other data that I have but I didn't present today is on the changes in ammonia and nitrate. We do see increases in ammonia in the soils that have biochar. We also see a corresponding decrease in nitrate. And there's no impact on nitrite at all during these incubations. So putting all of those pieces together, something is inhibiting the ammonia nitrification starting up the nitrous oxide cycle. And if we stop the production of nitrate, we stop the production of nitrous oxide.
So it's biological.
it's biological. It's one, yep.
Natalia Rogowska has a poster downstairs, which she's working with myself and Rick Cruz, who've shown, in some cases, up to 70% reduction in nitrous oxide emissions. It's correlated with changes in bulk density.
Well, we've seen the same thing in the laboratory, 50% reductions, which is, I want to know.
So there's a physical side and a change in water-filled pore space, and that's another possible explanation.
I mean, everything.
Maybe multiple, all of the above, who knows? We need to resolve this. Are there any questions for any of our other speakers?
The copper absorption work, you probably don't want to answer any questions. do you know what the iron concentration of that biochar might have been when those isotherms were done? I noted at the end you there was a comment there that the DTPA extractable iron.
Yeah, we have those measures, but I don't have them off the top of my head. But there would be some iron in those materials, but I don't know what.
Sorry, how that might be interfering with the ability to absorb copper.
From what I understand, this copper really absorbed onto the biochar. Copper is a little smaller than iron, and it can get into those materials. Sorry, I can't answer your question if I came on the spot. So.
Any other questions? Okay, well, I'd like to thank our speakers. I'd like to thank Jim, and we wish his wife a speedy recovery. There are posters downstairs. I think there's about six or seven biochar posters, and certainly invite you to all come downstairs to the poster session and view those and continue our discussions there.
You know,
thank you all.